Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here today to share the Dharma together. And a special welcome to our friends from the seminar of yesterday. Let me say a little bit about what it is to listen to Teisho. Listening to Teisho is just another form of Zazen. You continue your practice even as the Teisho happens. If you are working on an initial koan such as Mu, you just continue to work on the koan or on your shikantaza. If you're counting the breath, you continue to count the breath, unless that becomes difficult, in which case you just let go of the counting and become one with the listening. Don't try to analyze or figure out or assess what is being said. Just let the words flow through you like a river. It's perfectly okay to shift your posture if you need to during the Teisho, but however you sit, please keep the head up and the back straight. It's been quite some time since we've in any official way, in quotes, addressed our roots in classical Indian Buddhism, the fundamental teachings of the Buddha. We touch briefly on them in our introduction to Zen seminars, and for quite a few years we had regular talks and discussions about the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, the Five Hindrances, the Seven Factors of Enlightenment, and so on. But we've not taken an in-depth look at any of this in quite a while. So today I'd like to return to one little piece of that matter, and that is right view, sometimes called right understanding. These teachings of the Buddha are often referred to as doctrine, but they're not. The Buddha did not teach doctrine or cosmology or even ethics in the usual sense. He taught no rules, no regulations, no philosophy. You don't have to believe anything. You just do the practice. Everything the Buddha taught was practice. This is an important distinction. If you accept the teachings as doctrine, you limit yourself. You put yourself in a cage of rules and required beliefs. If you take the teachings as practice, if you enter them as practice, you are empowered. You take the responsibility for your own journey. And this, of course, applies to the very first teachings of the Buddha, the Four Noble Truths. The first noble truth, the truth of suffering, is the practice of suffering. It is the practice of awareness of suffering, the realization of suffering. The second noble truth is the practice and realization of the cause of suffering, the awareness of the existence of this illusory, separate ego self that suffers from the three poisons of greed, hatred, and ignorance. The third noble truth is the practice and realization of release from suffering, the letting go of that ego self and all the shocks and disappointments that it is heir to. And the fourth noble truth, the Eightfold Noble Path, is the specific practices that lead to liberation and the cessation of all illusion. The Eightfold Path is traditionally listed in three categories called the Three Trainings. The training of Prajna, Transcendent wisdom consists of right view and right intention. The training of Shila, morality or virtue, consists of right speech, right conduct, and right livelihood. Samadhi, the practice of absorption, consists of right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Now, the right and wrong spoken of here are not right versus wrong in any moralistic sense of sin versus virtue. The right is not cosmic or metaphysical opinion. Buddhism is very pragmatic in that sense. The Sanskrit word kusala means what works, what leads to practice and realization. And its opposite, akusala, means what doesn't work, what leads away into the world of delusion. Thus, right is effective, intelligent, and skillful means. Wrong is deluded, unskillful thinking and actions to be corrected, not a cosmic sin or an evil to be condemned. The Eightfold Path is sometimes characterized as a wheel with eight spokes, or a skein of eight threads all woven together. I like to think of it as an eight-lane highway, where you travel all eight lanes at once. That is to say, they all support each other. But there's something to be said for the traditional sequence. So today, let's take a look at this first piece of the Eightfold Path, right view. When we bring up right view in our seminars, we usually refer to right view as including at least a rudimentary understanding and a provisional acceptance of the Four Noble Truths. But let's face it, without at least a small inkling of understanding of oneself, the world, and the possibilities of living our lives in some way different from the usual thrust of our modern culture, none of us would be here in this room. Without right view, there is no practice. At the same time, right view is the deep, deep realization of oneself, the universe, and of one's true nature that comes out of lifetimes of practice. It is thus the end product of practice. So right view is the alpha and omega of our Zen practice. How does this right view begin to emerge? It could be a still, small internal voice that pops up at a certain age that begins to question, is this all there is? One may have a great job, family, house, all the things that we associate with success in this culture, and yet still feel incomplete. At first, we might try to fill that void with more stuff, more money, more possessions, a new car, a new house, maybe even a new spouse. All those things are temporary. They may satisfy for a while, but sooner or later, the new becomes the old, and we look for more, and we cycle endlessly through desire, fulfillment, satiation, boredom, disappointment, more desire, and so on and on. To try to end desire by satisfying it is like trying to put out a fire with gasoline. But when all the worldly goods, awards, promotions, and so on begin to seem just more of the same, and we begin to realize that we need to turn to a new direction, that is a beginning of right view. It may emerge slowly in this way, or just as a result of aging. Or it may come up suddenly through a profound experience, a walk in the mountains, seeing the ocean, hearing a piece of music, reading a phrase that strikes the heart, or maybe a personal tragedy, the loss of a loved one, a divorce. It might come up just from sitting and thinking, or even from an acid trip. Right view may arise as a deep spiritual angst, which is all too often diagnosed as depression or neurosis and treated with various medications. We sense, if only vaguely, that there is something far larger, far more profound than we see in everyday experience. A glimpse of something that cannot be encompassed by our usual thought or language processes. Something awesome, inspiring, and maybe even a bit frightening. For most people, most of the time, these moments of right view are temporary and soon forgotten. It's very hard to see the true significance of such experiences, and we tend to think, oh, cool, and move on. But for a very few, that moment, however fleeting, becomes right intention, an impetus to find out and seek a path. Right view is revealed in the dropping away of body and mind. It is not to be attained, learned, or acquired in any way. It is only realized. And only Buddhas realize it. To the extent that you let go of the separate self, to that exact extent, you see clearly the great reality. And to that exact extent, you are Buddha. Right view is part of prajna, the wisdom of our true nature, our Buddha nature, or one could say, the wisdom of the universe. The wisdom of the sun is to rise in the morning and set in the evening. The wisdom of the fish is to swim. The wisdom of the tree is to produce leaves. The wisdom of a bird is to fly. In a way, we can't help knowing prajna. We are already prajna. But if we don't recognize that fact, if we don't work to realize it, it is of no use. Mountains realize mountains. Trees realize trees. Rivers realize rivers. Walking realizes walking. Thought realizes thought. Zazen realizes Zazen. Buddha realizes Buddha. And is this all? No, it isn't. With very intense Zen practice, we might get an experience of the emptiness and the great reality relatively quickly. Body and mind drop away. We see clearly the emptiness of all dharmas, and we may even find ourselves in the express lane to nirvana. But that is not the way to Buddhahood. And therefore, it is not the way that we aspire to realize. It is not the path of the Bodhisattva. The path of the Bodhisattva wends its way endlessly through this world of coming and going, good and evil, man and woman, joy and sorrow, and all the ills that flesh is heir to. To see clearly that all is empty, that there is no self, and all that, is of course crucial. But to go there without explicitly addressing the self of time, space, and karma is to walk on very thin ice. It is all too easy to ignore aspects of the psychological self in the assumption that all we need to do is realize the unborn, as Bankei and even some current Zen teachers insist, and everything else will take care of itself. But it doesn't work that way. Yasutani Roshi insisted that the aim of practice is the perfection of character. But that does not mean that character development automatically comes with koan study or shikantaza or other formal aspects of training. The matter of character and the psychological self has to be addressed directly. The failure to do so can lead to disaster. The devastating effects of an incomplete view have been seen in the behavior of certain Zen teachers who, while they were in some sense truly realized and they trained genuinely realized successors, were later found to have engaged in abusive and even criminal acts with respect to some of their students. These teachers were deeply immersed in the formal aspects of the Dharma, all the practice forms, all the koans, breath practice, shikantaza, and so forth. But they had not paid enough attention to the precepts, and they had not delved into their own psychology, the foibles and weaknesses that are an intrinsic part of our human condition. Here's the Buddha's take from the Anguttara Nikaya, the Book of Gradual Sayings. I'm going to quote it at some length because it points up a very fundamental bedrock nature of our worldview. It's called the seed. Monks, I know not of any other single thing so apt to cause the arising of evil states and their increase as wrong view. In one of wrong view, evil states do arise and are apt to grow and grow. Monks, I know not of any other single thing so apt to cause the arising of good states and their increase as right view. In one of right view, good states do arise and are apt to grow and grow. Monks, in one of wrong view, all deeds whatsoever of body done according to that view, all deeds whatsoever of speech, of thought, all intentions, aspirations, and resolves, all activities whatsoever, all such things conduce to the unpleasant, the distasteful, the repulsive, the unprofitable, in short, to ill. What is the cause of that? It is wrong view. Suppose a nim seed, or a seed of a creeper or cucumber, be planted in moist soil. Those seeds are all plants that produce very bitter leaves. Whatever essence it derives from earth or water, it all conduces to its bitterness, its acidity, its unpleasantness. What is the cause of that? The ill nature of the seed. Just so, in one of wrong view, all deeds conduce to ill. What is the cause of that? It is wrong view. Monks, in one of right view, all deeds whatsoever of body done according to that view, all deeds whatsoever of speech, thought, all intentions, aspirations, and resolves, all activities whatsoever, all such things conduce to the pleasant, the dear and delightful, the profitable, in short, to happiness. What is the cause of that? It is right view. Suppose a seed of sugar cane or paddy or grape be planted in moist soil. Whatever essence it derives from earth or water, it all conduces to its sweetness, pleasantness, and delicious flavor. What is the cause of that? The happy nature of the seed. Just so, in one of right view, all deeds conduce to happiness. What is the cause of that? It is right view. Notice that emptiness, enlightenment, or dropping away of anything is not mentioned. He's dealing with what we could call the mundane or worldly aspects of right view. There is the Nazarene prophet, Yeshua, put it a little more succinctly. He said, "The eye is the lamp of the body. If your eye is clear, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. Matthew 6:22-23. The inherited, inculcated, learned, acquired aspects of how we view ourselves, the world, and our relationship to the world colors our every thought, word, and deed. It colors our every experience and sensory impression. It affects how we receive, process, remember, and respond to what we hear, see, taste, touch, smell, and feel. It determines our most basic values, our loves, our hates, our life goals and choices. It is identity in all caps. In the Mountains and Waters discourse, Dogen puts this business of identity or view and its impact on our perfections this way. He uses water as a metaphor for the great reality, that which is before the empty eon. All beings do not see mountains and waters in the same way. Some beings see waters as a jeweled ornament, but they do not regard jeweled ornaments as water. Some beings see water as wondrous blossoms, but they do not use blossoms as water. Hungry ghosts see water as raging fire or pus and blood. Dragons see water as a palace or a pavilion. Some beings see water as the seven treasures or the wish-granting jewel. Some beings see water as a forest or a wall. Some see it as the Dharma nature of pure liberation, the true human body, or as the form of body and essence of mind. One could expand on that. Some beings see water as a life of service. Others see water as a life of grasping. It all depends on your view. Zen Buddhism evolved as a monastic practice, and much of what we do here is still based on the monastic model. However, in our lay practice do we address this matter that seems to be missing in our koan collections and so much of the formal Buddhist literature? One very important and very obvious way is through the practice of the precepts, the ethical teachings of the Buddha. Ethical behavior, the good life in the highest sense, is inextricably bound up with right view. Like all else in Buddhism, the precepts are not ideas, rules, or notions about being good. The precepts are a practice. They are a practice of perfection. It is not that we ever become perfect in the usual sense, but to be aware of them, to practice and maintain the awareness of not killing, of not stealing, not misusing sex, not lying, not taking or dealing in drugs, and so on, is a part of the path that we walk. It is possible to work with the precepts three times in our training here. It's part of the every minute Zen training. They are studied as part of the preparation for Jukai, and they are worked on as koans at the very end of one's formal koan training. Another way is through the Every Minute Zen Mindfulness Training Program, developed by our Dharma Father, Danen Henry Roshi. For me, the mindfulness practice of Every Minute Zen is one of the most important practices for the lay practitioner in developing right view. Every Minute Zen is a series of mindfulness exercises entered into with the guidance of a teacher in Dokusan. It begins by taking everyday habitual activities one at a time and using each one as a signal to pause and recollect oneself, to recollect and settle into the moment, and then move on with your day. It is a form of little moments of zazen outside the zendo and off the mat in the far more challenging environment of the marketplace. It may be hard for the beginner to believe, but practice on the mat is relatively easy. Everything that we do here in the Zendo, all our forms and protocols, chanting and ceremonies, is directed to enhance the practice of Zazen. It is in the wide world, the craziness of our culture, that we are really challenged. And of course, in this current election season, those challenges are on steroids. But the really important aspect of Every Minute Zen is the process of exploring the mindscape, seeing our emotional and mental reactions to various situations. When does anger arise? When does envy, greed, jealousy, and all the rest of it happen? Can we see it before it gets out into speech and action? Can we let go of the negative stuff, and can we forgive ourselves for just being human without becoming complacent? Over time, these momentary respites of Zazen merge into a continuum of causeless awareness. And together with our work on the mat, in Doksan and formal practice, leads to a life of greater acceptance, affection, and equanimity. Here's a quote from the Every Minute Zen manual. This is the practice of being aware of our existence as we live. It is the practice of being present and observing impartially, carefully, everything that is taking place within ourselves and outside of ourselves, without any judgments, opinions, or evaluations, just being present, aware. It is the work of experiencing ourselves just as we are, without any cosmetic job whatsoever. It is the work of experiencing the world just as it is. The precepts and Every Minute Zen are skillful means to get us to introspect into our own stuff, to see the weaknesses and foibles that are part of the human condition, and to forgive them, but at the same time to vow to continue to work to let them go. Right view includes the willingness to see clearly our world of time, space, and karma, that actions have consequences, that there is life and death, good and evil, ignorance and enlightenment. There is spiritual practice and training. There are those who have attained the way and those who have not. In other words, we have to embrace delusive wisdom. For without a clear understanding and acceptance of worldly reality in all its messiness, blood, sweat, and tears, practice becomes a self-centered attempt to escape, to separate. We're not trying to escape anything. We have to be willing to face our lives squarely, without judgment or wishful thinking. We're in a very exciting time in our Sangha. Right now, our floating Zendo is working surprisingly well. But there are also significant problems. There are many forms that we can't do very, very easily in our present circumstances. Samu and other forms of work practice, Oryoki, that's meal practice, and Sesshin. So we continue to seek a permanent home, which will allow us to once more offer a comprehensive practice that not only includes these, but other practices that we have yet to discover. All of which help us to let go of the clinging self and realize right view, and then to come forth for the benefit of ourselves, the Sangha, our families and communities, and all sentient beings. And together with all beings, we realize the way.